Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah. How is everyone doing today?
Alhamdulillah.
MashaAllah. So what's been going on over this week? Anything specific?
Race riots.
Riots, yeah? What did you guys make of the riots?
It's opportunity.
Some of this may get cut out, but I think it's a good opportunity. Because there may be some lessons for us. Mm. So put your dawah hats on, right? The stuff we've been discussing past couple of weeks.
Well, it proves that the why dawah is so important. You know, especially since we have so much disinformation and we have so many people out there whose jobs it is to provide disinformation, misinformation, misguide the public, and particularly people that are not highly educated can be more susceptible to these kind of things. So we need to express the true message of Islam. Convey the message properly, with politeness, and you know. So this is evidence of why dawah is so important to us.
Yeah,
I think to add on to that.
Yeah,
obviously we have the figureheads and the people on top who are pushing this kind of agenda against the Muslims, but I think, like the layman and the general people, there are a lot of people that are brainwashed maybe, and that's where people like us come in to do dawah to them, to show them the truth. Because they could have open hearts, but their fitrah is corrupted right now.
Yeah, mashallah. He's hit all the key points of the stuff. The fitrah is corrupted and everything, yeah. Covered. Anyone else want to share anything?
Yeah, maybe just an extension of what Tariq said. I think the misinformation, disinformation, like politically as well, but then when you talk about the religion aspect of it, it's symbolic, emblematic of what people's perception of Islam is. Even a lot of us Muslims, we call ourselves Muslims, but we sometimes don't know how to defend it or portray it with etiquette that, you know, the Prophet acted. And perhaps many of us act in ways which isn't, you could say, on that level of etiquette or perhaps Islamic. So that disinformation, misinformation in politics, it can be translated to the dawah and just how to act correctly as a Muslim, not only internally but on the outside as well. So
yeah, especially with what's going on, it's key, isn't it? Like, people are going to be looking at what Muslims are doing and how they're responding. I think generally, what do you guys think? I think generally so far the Muslim response has been quite
tempered.
Yeah, it's been quite, you know. Absolutely. Yeah, there was one or two like unfortunate events where some Muslim youth, you know, reacted probably not in the best way, but it was rectified at least, you know. Anything else on that sort of issue as far as...
Yeah, maybe it's just the aspect of you've got, and this is more like political, you have like instigators, foreign agents, external forces trying to amplify the chaos, amplify the fire, trying to cause enemies and divisions both from different parties and maybe internally as well. So it's about identifying who the enemy really is or who maybe what the ideology that we're attacking, not these individuals. So it's just trying to look at it from maybe a holistic perspective, and actually this issue is more kind of not a Muslim Islamic one, but more of like a social political issue, something stemming from something larger, if you catch my understanding.
Makes sense, anyone else want to share anything on this, like about how, you know, maybe the pressures of social media and the way it may make people act in certain ways or behave in certain ways?
I think in today's age, we can see that the role of social media on changing people's mind. So one fake news can bring up this type of riots in the country all over. So if we think the other side of it, we can use the social media to change people's mind for the positive. So it really is impactful.
Yeah,
I think what's important for the working class white people who are like the bulk of the riots, they need to realize that they have more in common with the Muslim man or woman than they think. A lot of Muslims in this country are working class. They all have families they need to look after. They're all struggling with cost of living crisis. The same problems that the working class people have, the white people, but different blame. The working class white people are told to blame the immigrants, who is another word for Muslims, and they don't realize that the problem is the man in the suit up there who's causing all these issues, who's causing the cost of living crisis, the inflation, the interest rates, or whatever is impacting their lives. But they're told to look at the Muslim guy, the guy next door, his neighbour, that's taken all his jobs and his money and benefits and whatnot. But when they look at each other and realise they have more in common, and then they can look to the man in the suit and see how they can solve that issue.
Yeah, yeah. So, I mean, there's been some really important lessons as well, isn't it, throughout the week, you know, especially the way, I think the what's relevant to us is, one of the things relevant to us, one of the things we discussed in session one, which was, you know, the role of social media in the dawah. Now, obviously, the rights aren't specifically related to the dawah, but there has been, or there is a dawah angle here, which is, what is the response of the Muslims going to be like? You know, that's going to determine quite a bit as far as what the portrayal of Muslims is going forward in some cases as well. So, and that, the way you act and behave, as the brother said earlier, you know, is a part of your dawah. You know, these people see this and they then have a certain perception of you in their mind, what they think of you as Muslims. You know, and that may determine further on if they will take what you're saying to be of importance or containing truth as well. Because if you come across a certain way, an aggressive way, you do what the aggressors are doing and you just act the same way, say for example these crazy thugs on the streets that are vandalizing things and terrorizing people are doing, then why would people think of you any differently, right? So you need to think long term as well from this perspective. So dawah is going to play a key role, inshallah, going forward. You know, these are opportunities, these aren't times to shy away. It's important to now go and clarify and share with people what Islam really is. Because there have been a lot of people misrepresenting Islam. Some of the, you know, far right, you know, the guys that are just inflaming the whole situation, the public figures, you know, they're spewing all this nonsense about Islam. You know, that Islam is the problem, this is the issue, all of this stuff. Now, who's going to clear that up? You know, Muslims have to do that. They need to speak about this stuff. And this is a part of your dawah as well. And obviously the Muslims as well, we've seen, you know, no point taking names here, but there's been certain figures who have maybe not acted in the best way, you know, as Muslims on social media, who are influential, who have the power and the influence. And you can see the impact that has, you know, on the masses. So, and this is related to us guys, because when you do get involved in the dawah, as we discussed in session one, a lot of your role is going to be online. It may be online, you know, a lot of dawah is online these days. So when you get online, and if you become quote-unquote popular online, whatever, however you want to define that, or successful online and however you want to define that, you have to be extremely responsible. And this is why we emphasize all of this in session one. You know, you have to be responsible, you have to make sure you're measured with what you say. You know, you ask yourself why you're doing what you're doing, who you're doing it for, you know. Is there a need for you to do it? Or is someone already doing this? You know, is this something that you can do or cover? Because not everyone's going to be good at everything. Right? Some people may be skilled at one thing, others may be skilled at another thing. You know, so if you're doing something which isn't your forte, you know, and someone else is already doing it and doing a good job of it, you need to ask yourself, well, why are you doing it? You know, so, but asking those questions is important, because that will really help with your intention, which is the key, which is the essence. You know, why do we do the dawah? Why are we in the dawah? Who are we doing it for? These are key questions, inshallah, right? So aside from that, carrying on from our last sessions now, inshallah. Where did we leave off last time? What did we discuss? Does anyone remember last session?
Was it manners and etiquettes?
There was a part of it.
Yeah.
But there was something else we also went over.
Oh, yeah. Controlling the initiation. Conversation.
Yeah.
Or the initiation.
Initiate. So starting the conversation.
Start conversation, yeah. Or how to... approach someone, or yeah. How, if somebody approaches
you, yes.
How we can start a conversation and convince them for.
Yeah, and what were the key principles questions we learned? So to, you know,
not be on the back foot, like you steer the conversation where you want it to go, because they can ask you a very, like, yes or no kind of question. I think the example you gave was, what's the weather today, yes or no? It's like these kind of questions they ask us, which are very hard to deal with unless we deconstruct it and take it where we want to take it.
Okay. Also, you mentioned that if they approach you with a certain question, like that's antagonistic, like they come, what was the age of Aisha or something? that you say, I'll be happy to answer your question, but I'd like to explain a few things to you beforehand.
Yeah.
And then you guide it into the, you know, to
the fundamentals.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Okay, so why do we do that? That transition? What were the, we said a couple of reasons to do that. Right?
It's because we're trying to explain our worldview.
Yeah, why is it important to explain our worldview?
Because worldviews have certain presumptions, so you can explain anything you want, but if they're still in their worldview, then it won't matter to them.
Yeah.
So you have to explain your own worldview, then what you explain will matter.
Yes, yeah. So essentially what we talked about, worldviews, right? And the people we're speaking to, especially in the West, in the UK, they will come from a certain worldview, which is different from our worldview, which is Islam. Now, their perspective may be a type of secular, liberal, atheist paradigm, that type of worldview that they're coming from. And that means that they'll have some fundamental beliefs that they hold on to and views that they have, which would be completely different from ours. Their way of looking at reality is going to be different from ours. And therefore, if we, when they have certain questions, such as, you know, we discussed a lot about the equality between men and women, and that notion of equality between men and women. Now, they're going to have a certain perception of that, an idea of that, based on their worldview. Ours is different, right? Now, if they ask you a question about why women cover the way they do and men cover the way they do, and there is a difference, clearly, no matter how well you explain or articulate it to them, they're never going to be fully satisfied. And the reason is, it's not because you didn't do a good job. The reason is because their worldview is different. So that's why we go back to those foundations, because those foundations are the key principles of our worldview, which is Islam. So at the very least, once you've given them those foundations, they can at least appreciate why we believe what we believe, even if they don't agree with this, though. But at least they'll have that framework, right? So it's important to give them that. Because if you just give them the answer, and they process that through their worldview, they're never going to understand it or appreciate it at all. Right? It's like the example I gave you. Imagine you guys are here already, and you're wearing red-colored glasses, red-tinted glasses, and the wall behind me is white. Now, when you look at the wall, you see it as red, right? Because you're looking through those red-tinted glasses. I walk in with clear glasses. What color do I see?
White.
White. Now, how am I going to convince you that the wall is not red, it's white?
To remove the tinted glasses.
That's the only way. I can argue with you all day, but if you keep looking through your lenses, you're seeing red. So what I'm saying is not going to make any sense. So you have to remove those lenses and wear the clear lenses, right? Put on the clear lenses, and then you will see what I see. Even if you don't like it, that's a different story, but at least you appreciate what I see, because you're now seeing it yourself. So the lenses are like a worldview. A worldview is like a lens. It covers our perception and our, you know, how we see reality, right? So this was one of the key reasons why it's important to take them to the foundations of Islam. Whatever question they have. Yes, we'll answer it for you. I'd love to help you with it. But before I do that, let me share some of the foundations or the fundamentals of Islam with you first. Okay? What was the other reason to do that? Yes.
We have a limited time.
Limited
so
time.
So we want to use it before we go with these lengthy questions and answers. We want to use the opportunity to tell them about Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala.
Yeah.
And at least if they are leaving us, we should give them at least some basics about Islam and Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. Otherwise, if they leave with that conversation, they would go and they have nothing. They have no information about Islam.
Absolutely.
And God.
100%. Yeah.
Also, we can, if they're really sincere, we can take their details and send them information afterwards.
So it's like a sieve. Mm-hmm. Right? You sieve out the, you know, like you sieve flour. So it's like that. So if they're genuinely there to learn, then when you say to them, I'll help you with the answer to your question, but I'm going to share some of the fundamentals with you first, if that's okay, they should be more than happy, because they really want to learn. And you've told them it's important for them to understand the foundations before they get the answer to their question. Right? But if they're there just to argue with you, or debate with you, and have fun, then they're not really going to be okay with that, because they just want to pin you down on a certain point. Right? So this way, and you're taking control of the conversation as well, and directing it to what's important, which the brother said, you establish hujjah at least. You give them, you tell them who Allah is, you tell them who the Prophet ﷺ was, you tell them what the Quran is, you tell them what the purpose of life is, you tell them the foundational ideas and principles of Islam, right? Because reality is, you know, conversations with people normally don't last more than, say, 30 minutes. You know, unless you're, you know, you have 3-4 hours, you're at a coffee shop with someone, it's, you know, most of the time, 30 minutes, max an hour,
15 minutes, lunch break, whatever the case is. You're not going to have much time. And if you go into a discussion on, say, the fiqh of fasting or something like this, and they ask you about fasting, sure, they may learn something about fasting in Islam, but when they leave that conversation, do they know who created them? Do they know where they're going after death, what life is all about? They don't have answers to these questions. They don't even know anything about Islam, except that some of the principles as to why we fast. So you haven't really helped them, you know, in the grand scheme of things. So this is why this technique is very powerful from many different perspectives. You know, it gives you control. It redirects the conversation to what's really important, which is the foundations of Islam. It helps us establish our worldview, which will help them with the answer to the question anyway. And it acts as a sifting mechanism, you know. So it removes the people that are just there to debate and argue with you, right? So everyone okay with this so far?
Yes.
Yeah. Okay, so now we're going to go into what are those fundamentals. So say you're speaking to Bob, your neighbor, and he agrees with you to sit down with you and have a discussion now. What are those foundations? So the first thing we want to start with is establishing whether they believe in God or not, right? Because that is the most fundamental point. And the best way to do this is not to assume that they believe or they don't believe or they're agnostic and they're unsure. Don't assume anything. Just ask them, what do you believe? Do you believe in God? What's your beliefs in regards to God or a higher power? Just ask them the question. And we said that there'll be three main answers you'll get in one form or the other. What were the three answers you may receive to that question?
Yes.
Yes, no, I do.
No.
No, I don't.
I'm not sure.
Yeah. So you get the theist, or let's say a believer answer, because it could be a deistic type of belief they may have. So a believer, you'll get an atheist type, or you'll get an agnostic type, right? One of the three. The first one, if they say, yes, I believe in God or a higher power, then we don't have to spend much time on the G of the Gorab here. Yeah? We can go straight to the O, which is oneness. Okay. If they say, I'm not sure, I don't know, or I don't believe, then we address that first, okay? So let's start with the person that says, I don't believe God exists. So it's more of a definitive type of answer. What do you think we should do at this point?
If he says, I believe?
He says, I don't believe God exists.
We should go with the existence of God first.
Yeah, but even before you give them any arguments, what do you think you should do with this person?
I'll make him question now.
Making a question?
Yeah, I will probably ask him, so if you think there is no God, what's your understanding of the creation then?
Okay, good. So ask further questions, right? Or you want to ask them why they don't believe.
Yeah.
Right? This is important. Again, get them to think. Because as soon as you ask a person who says, I don't believe in God, why don't you believe in God, their mind's going to start thinking, right? Now, chances are they're going to realize they haven't got a good reason not to believe in God, other than an emotional reason, probably, right? Because let's think about this. What good arguments are there against the existence of God or for atheism? What do you guys think?
Can't see it.
It's not really.
I can't see God.
Okay. Can't see God.
Suffering?
No evidence.
Okay.
Yeah.
No evidence?
You see?
Yeah, but no evidence isn't really an argument. Mm. You know, it's just a point.
It's a form of control by the religious states and organizations. So it's like a cynical, materialistic. They see it as power.
Yeah. So they may have that notion. Yeah.
Well, if they say something like, "I don't know if God exists, but I know you don't know either."
Okay.
And the most probable thing is that there isn't one.
So in that case, we continue and we can give them our reasons. But what we want to get at here is try to see if we can get this person to realize that they don't really have good reasons to deny God. Reasons to deny God.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
They may have certain beliefs or views that they may hold on to, but have they got good reasons, substantial reasons to say? Because remember, to say there is, if someone says, I don't believe there is a God, that is a knowledge claim. That is a positive knowledge claim. Right, that he's saying, I don't believe there is a God. So there has to be reasons behind that. You can't just, some people do that. They just make claims without no reason. And then you can expose that by asking them the question, exposing that for them. But when you make a positive knowledge claim, you have to validate it. You have to justify it. So when you ask them why you don't believe, you're going deep into them and getting them to realize, well, have you got a justification for the belief you hold? Right? In most cases, they won't have one. And I want us to explore this. Let's think about, really think about reasons, rational reasons for, or arguments, proofs for why God doesn't exist. What do you guys think?
Proofs or like emotional stuff?
Proof of why it doesn't
exist.
Think
about proofs. Emotional stuff, there's a lot of that there. Why God doesn't exist. Any valid arguments for proving that God does not exist?
Who created God?
Okay,
so it's like that infinite regress. And all.
Yeah. But that's passing on the buck in a way. So let's deal with God first, you know.
These theoretical ideas that they have, like Darwinism and other stuff, evolution. They believe evolution.
Yeah, but evolution doesn't disprove God.
Yeah.
I mean, even if someone believes evolution is true, it doesn't mean God doesn't exist. It just means God created a process through which he allowed for life to evolve.
Mm-hmm. I believe in like randomness and chaos, Big Bang, like there is no agency. Everything's chaotic, everything's random, everything's by chance. Maybe that kind of argument, like, my God is chaos, my God is randomness, you could argue. Okay.
So let's work with that one for a second. So someone that says, I believe in chaos, randomness. It's all random, it's all chaotic, it just came by chance. And that is my proof for why there isn't an intelligent being creator. Mm. How would you guys address that?
You could say that, you know, if you truly look at the universe, you can see uniformity, stability, and order.
Okay.
So that kind of contradicts what they're saying about everything being random and chaotic. So, you know, it's kind of defeats the argument.
Yeah, so that's a very powerful thing to point out. So someone makes that claim. All you have to do is show that their belief that everything is random and chaotic is not true, at least not on every level, right? So there is order within the universe.
Fine-tuning.
Atheist scientists have acknowledged this.
If it's luck, it's just by chance, isn't it?
Okay, so what about the chance? They'll say, well, say they've shifted gears now. They say, fine, it's not chaotic, there's order, but it's by chance. The order is there.
It takes more faith to believe it was by chance than to believe it was from a higher power.
Okay, so
and they'll say, "Oh, then why do we have cancer? Why do we have genocide? No, that's God is evil."
That's emotional.
It's emotional. Yeah.
That's evil. That's the Turing evil.
Yeah. Okay, so let's work with that. Yeah,
that's what naturally would happen. I'm just trying to think.
Yeah, they will shift gears.
And there's like, okay, but then there's like, but. I think that'll be the next logical conclusion. But like, okay, your God exists, then why is he doing all this sort of stuff? Yeah. It makes all sense to me. It's easy for me not to believe. You know, that's how they would.
But that's good, because now we've shifted them from a logical discussion to exposing that it's an emotional problem for them, right? And that's where we want to go at the end. If that is really the problem for the people, this person.
It's just one logical thought. Yeah. I think it's generally what happens, right?
Yeah, it trickles down. You'll see starts off logical and then it trickles into this emotional discussion, right? But we'll deal with that in a minute. But let's just really sort of isolate and pinpoint this whole logical side of it, this whole chaos. So you can show order, right? Mm-hmm. You can highlight the fine-tuning of the universe. You can highlight the laws of physics, the laws of mathematics, the laws of logic. There is clear order there. If there's laws, what do laws necessitate?
Order.
A lawmaker.
Where do laws come from?
A lawmaker.
A lawmaker, a lawgiver. You're not going to get laws that emerge out of nothing or by chance, right? Now, they may say, but there's a chance. How would you address this? But there's still a chance.
I'll give an example. I will give an example and ask them if that's possible. Like throwing papers on the floor and say, are you telling me that after X amount of years or certain years or millions of years, the papers will become a book or something?
Yeah, they'll say, there's a very small chance, but it can happen. Is it a possibility?
Yeah, but then I would say, like Ahmed mentioned, I would say that requires way more faith. Mm. Than actually believing in a creator.
Yeah, but they'll say, yeah, sure, but it's still a possibility. Do you acknowledge it's a possibility? If it's a possibility, then it can happen. Even if there's a small chance of it happening.
I don't acknowledge it's a possibility.
You don't?
I don't acknowledge that it's a possibility.
Do you acknowledge that you exist?
Oh,
and it becomes to that, yeah.
Like, I think one of the best...
That's what you would say.
Ways to tackle it would be asking them if they believe the universe was created or came from nothing.
They'll say, there's a chance it came from nothing.
Okay.
Because the chance card is big. A lot of them play the chance card when they
start. I think no philosopher or physicist believes that the universe came from nothing. So I would be shocked if they said that. And if they did say that, then I would be like, oh, how is it possible something can come from nothing? And I would ask them to explain me that.
They'll just say, but if there is a possibility of a chance, then it's possible that it can
a
happen.
A chance of what?
The universe came from nothing, or the universe somehow ordered itself.
There is no chance. There is no chance for something to come from nothing.
So you're saying it's 100% that the universe was created?
Absolutely. There is an intelligence.
Because that is belief.
That is really like that's a lot of faith. You're telling me there's nothing and suddenly something comes?
That takes a religion.
So you guys are right. It takes a lot of faith to go with that 0.00005% chance.
Can we stress that, you know, are you willing to take that chance?
Well, you could do that.
Yeah.
Why would you take the most unlikely possibility over what's most likely? And this is the sort of track is a good way to expose this sort of chance hypothesis that they bring up here. Is just outline to them, okay, look at all other aspects of your life. Everything you believe in your life. Are you 100% convinced of the things, everything else you believe in your life? Most likely no. Most people are not. Don't believe in things because they're 100% convinced of those things. Right? You know the example the brothers use about your mother being your mother? Yeah? So you can ask them, well, do you believe your parents are your parents? They'll say yes. Everyone believes their parents are their parents. Let's do it right now. All of you guys believe your parents are your parents?
Yeah.
Yeah? Yeah? Yes. Everyone does. Okay. Are you 100% sure of that? Yes.
You physically can't be.
Naturally, yeah. Emotionally, you can't be.
Okay, but are you emotional? Do you believe it's the truth?
Yeah. Internally.
But as far as evidence, what do you have?
My birth certificate.
Okay.
No, well, that's mother and they are dependent.
So it's testimony.
Yeah.
Yes, the testimony of reliable sources
that's
have
belief.
Informed you that they're your parents.
Yeah.
And that's valid, bro. There's nothing wrong with that. That's what we do throughout for everything else in our life as well. In fact, most things we believe in we don't believe in them because of scientific evidence. We believe in them for other reasons, valid reasons like testimony, reasoning, etc. Right? But the point is that there is a certain level, a threshold, you know. If something is like 80%, 90% most likely, we believe in it as humans, right? Anything else in our life as well. If there's a great chance of something being true, we accept it. If there's a small chance of something being true, we don't normally accept it. Because we use common sense, right? We use common sense as human beings. But when it comes to God, the question of God, their standards change suddenly, right? It goes from like 60, 70% all the way up to 100%. I need 100% conviction. Right, and this is a problem. So this again exposes that something else is going on. It's not a rational problem. So pick up on these things when you notice them doing this stuff.
To be fair,
right?
If I was talking to someone and someone said to me, "There's a chance the universe comes from nothing,"
yeah,
I would probably not continue the conversation, or I would generally try to go deep into what's actually the reason why this person doesn't believe in God, because it's not about something. It's not a logical reason. It must be something emotional, or something that happened in their life, or they got bullied, whether it's school or something. But
yeah.
I wouldn't want to continue the conversation.
But this is good. This is where you want to be, guys. Yeah. As soon as you realize someone is playing this chance card, or going with the most unlikely possibilities, that should be a red flag that something else is going on. And what should you do if you realize? Remember the keys to the fitrah. Yeah. So we're using this key now. We're trying to logically and psychologically go into their minds. It's not working. The logic, you know, the standards of what could be correct are changing. You can see that. So what should you do? You should change the key now, right?
We can challenge them as well if they are making questions. So there are too many challenges in their questions as well. For example, if somebody says that the universe came from nothing, then we say, do we see anything in today's life which can be seem logical if it has come from nothing? For example, this table, this chair, this camera, everything.
Yeah.
Can it be came from nothing?
So we're saying human experience.
Yeah.
That's what we have, right?
Yeah. If they say no, then how can this big universe come from nothing?
Simple.
And if it comes from nothing, we have a purpose in everything, behind everything. For example, table, TV, everything. It has a purpose in behind the creator. Has a purpose for its creation. So if this big universe and this order and everything, so what's the purpose of this then?
Yeah.
If they say there's no purpose, it's illogical, then it doesn't make sense, because there should be someone. And how it can continue for millions of years without disruption?
Yeah.
the sun is on the same direction, yeah. It evolved in its direction, the moon, everything. So how can this could be? Even the, who can teach the children to take the breastfeeding on a correct way? Mm. Who is teaching the children? Yeah. Logically, we can say the children has no mind to think about this like adults. So who tell them to, let's say we call suck, yeah? Suck the milk. Also, this human being, 8 billion people in the world, and everything is controlled, the universe, the oceans, who control that?
Yeah.
So we can challenge them on their own arguments.
Yeah. And simply, so simple logical points. Intuitive points, brothers, yes. Simple. Remember, there's this beauty in simplicity. When you make simple arguments, they make sense. People feel that, right? It's beyond, okay, what percent, you know, what level is this argument the brother making? Is it like a 90% out of 100? Is it 95%? People don't think in that way. They think, okay, does this make sense? Is it rational? Is it intuitive? And then people accept, right? Those that want to accept. Those that want to deny, they will deny the most clearest of evidences as well. Right, Allah gives us examples of this in the Quran. You know, there's people that if Allah says, if He opened up a doorway into heaven and they started to climb through it, these people will say, our eyes are bewitching us, we're seeing things, this is not real. So if someone wants to deny it, they will deny even miracles if they had to.
They have, right? Done.
Yeah, people have done. Yeah. Right, so Pharaoh, for example, right, clearly he was shown miracles, he was given many miracles through Moses, he denied them because he didn't want to believe. So there's this want point as well, this the will of the person, do they want to acknowledge the truth or not? You know, and a lot of times, if they don't want to believe, then no matter what rational arguments you give them, they're not going to accept it. They may just play the chance card or whatever the case is, right? But really expose that chance point to them as well. So for example, one thing you could do is say, look, if I blindfolded you right now, and I said, run across a busy motorway, and there is a 5 or 15% chance you'll survive, right? Just 50 or say there's, yeah, a 20% chance you'll survive. Would you do that? Who would do that? You won't do that, right? Why? Because 80% you're going to get hit by a car, right? So you won't take that risk, right? So that evidence is sufficient for you. That small amount of evidence is sufficient for you. Why is it when it comes to God's existence you change the standards? You want 100% proof, and you want this to be perfect and that to be perfect, right? So it just exposed that bias that they have going on with their standards of you know what it takes to believe in something.
How just on a separate point, how much should you stress the consequences? Because obviously you want this to be a friendly conversation, and you know, as the brother said, you've only got 5 minutes.
Yeah,
but you know, you have the consequences of like eternal torment and things like that. Is that something that you should not stress that much?
No, you should.
You should.
But remember what we said. It's, you know, what you say, a lot of it's how you say it. Mm. You know, so if you say that in a way that you're genuinely concerned and you care for the person, it's not going to come across in the wrong way. Mm. But if you say it in a derogatory way, looking down upon them, trying to, you just make them feel scared for no reason, you know, then it's going to come across that way. But definitely mention that. It's an example of the crossing the road blindfolded. Mm-hmm. It's that fear, isn't it, of being hit by the car. The consequences of taking that chance, which stops them. So add that to the mix if you have to. Remind them that, you know, you're going with the 0.005% chance of something happening, and you're risking your eternity for just the 0.005% chance. Why would you do that? Mm-hmm. What sane person would do that? So add that in there if you want, inshallah, definitely.
Just to add, I think what you said about how no matter what evidence you give, a lot of some people just will never believe. Even if they were on the earth for 1,000 years, they still wouldn't believe. So I think it's a good insight into why the punishment for shirk and disbelief is so big, because some people can't fathom it. Like, oh, I'm on this earth for 60, 70 years and then I get punished for eternity. Why? But I think that's a good reason why, that even if you were on earth for 1,000,000 years, you still wouldn't believe. So that's why the punishment is so big.
Yeah, and that's a common question as well. You know, they call it the problem of hell or something, where they say, why would God punish someone for an eternity, you know, for a crime committed in a temporal life for a couple of years, right? So
maybe we can quickly touch upon that as well. So one way of answering is, you know, obviously if you had lived for eternity, you'd still not believe. And Allah knows that, because Allah knows past, present, future and all possibilities. So that would be the case, and that's why your punishment is so severe. What other way, how else could you address that?
It's transgression. So if you say that, you know, if you use that logic, you can say, how long did it take to stab a person? So you've transgressed, like it takes 3 seconds or 4 seconds. So should that person be punished for 3 seconds or 4 seconds?
That's a nice point, Marshall. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So it's not about the duration.
It's
in time.
Not time-based. Yeah.
It's not time-based. Yeah.
It's who you're sinning against.
Mm. So what is it, what are you saying, in other words, Tariq? What you're highlighting is that people are focusing on the wrong thing. Mm-hmm. How severe is the crime?
Yes. Yeah.
Which leads to such a punishment.
Mm-hmm.
Exactly. That's what people need to be asked thinking about, because they're undermining the severity of shirk. Mm-hmm. They think it's something just minor, nothing important. So why would God punish for an eternity? Mm-hmm. Right? So you need to reframe it for them. Look, if God is all-knowing, all-wise, the most forgiving, the one that knows everything, the one that wants best for you, the most just, if He has prescribed a specific punishment for a specific crime, in this case, eternal punishment for shirk, someone dying upon shirk, then there's no injustice in that. The real question is, how severe must that crime be?
Yeah.
That's what people are not appreciating.
Because if we say that, you know, Allah, you're rejecting Allah, and Allah is sustaining you for every moment that you're on this earth. So every breath you take, every, you know, your health and your, you know, you've got 70 years of this, and you're redirecting the veneration that should be going to Allah, to other things. So that's like the ultimate ingratitude. So, you know, you can frame
it. You can share some of the wisdoms behind it. Yes. Get them to appreciate that point. Mm-hmm. Yeah, definitely. Mm-hmm. Right? Okay, so going back to that point, they've said they don't believe in God. You've asked them, what reasons do you have not to believe? And chances are they won't have any good reasons anyway. The best they can come up with is the problem of evil. Right? That I've heard. Because there is no positive arguments against the existence of God. Right? It's normally what we can call an emotional argument, which is, why is there so much evil and suffering? If a good, all-powerful God exists, why is there so much evil and suffering on the earth?
What if they reframe the question saying humans are emotional by nature and they have this fitrah by nature, so it's kind of like it's more emotional and it's more required for a human to believe in God, and just flip it, they flip it over to you being like it's an emotional argument for God instead of a logical one, maybe if you...
For believing in God?
Yeah, so when I speak to my friends, I say, oh, because people need something to believe in. That he always keeps on saying this, they need something to believe in. So it might work for them, but it doesn't work for me and stuff like this. So this is the kind.
You can highlight to them that, look, sure, there may be an aspect of human nature, the need to believe and the need to submit and to worship, which we would argue as well, Islamically, from the perspective of the fitrah, it is the case. But that doesn't now logically follow that because humans have a need to worship, therefore they created God. It doesn't logically mean that that's the only conclusion. It could be one possible outcome where people have a need and they fill that need by creating something, but it doesn't have to be the case. It could be the case that, no, Allah exists and He created the human being with a need which reminds him of so he turns back to Him. Do you see? And relies upon Him.
Because I always get... Because sometimes you got two types of people I come across where they believe in something. It's okay, I believe in something, but... You know, the attributes of God, the religion, you got to justify that to me, and like, so that's a separate thing.
Yeah.
But then it's like, okay, for like it works for all these people, you know, for you it might work for you, it's good for you, but I don't need it. It doesn't work for me. It's like they have like a pragmatic outlook,
utilitarian type of
And they say, okay, he's got a very when I speak with this guy, it's like I get that emotional sentiment because he grew up in a Catholic upbringing, Italian, you know, stuff like this. Mm. So it's like there's like kind of like he's got this cynical understanding of religion, mainly from the Christian Catholicism, you know, the monasteries, the Vatican and stuff like this. And this is just my kind of inference from it. But like, he has this very pragmatic, cynical understanding of religion. And it says, yeah, it works for some people. It doesn't need to work for me.
Okay, so let's that's a good point. And a lot of people would say that as well. I don't have a need for religion or God.
Yeah.
It works for you, fantastic. Do your thing. But I don't feel the need. And actually, a lot of people will feel like that these days, because a lot of people feel self-sufficient and independent.
Because they worship. Because then you can reframe the question, well, what is God? And it's like, your desires are your God, no problem. But like their understanding is like, when they think of God, they think of like the monotheistic understanding of God.
Yeah.
But like, okay, no problem. Then we're changing definitions of God, because if I'm worshipping my desires, I'm not talking about that God. I'm talking about like the religion God, like the one God, the Islamic God, the Christian God, the Jewish God, whatever God. So
okay, so how can we address this, guys? This is a good question.
I'd argue that this person is also a slave to utility or to hedonism. Or
yeah, but as you said, that's fine.
I enjoy it. You know, it's, it works for me.
I'd argue, what is it better to worship? Something that is all-knowing, all-wise, all-powerful, or something that is limited? I'd argue that what they're worshipping is very pointless.
But they'll just say, yeah, sure, I can see your concept may be superior to my concept, but my concept works for me. I'm happy with it. You know, I'm getting by, I'm enjoying myself, I'm having fun.
And then I always say to him, what if like you're wrong and stuff like this? He always says, well, we'll find out. When I'm dead, we'll find out.
Because they're not concerned.
They don't care?
They're happy right now. Everything is good. Everything, my life is good. Even if my so-called Lord, my desires are very limited, they're working for me. So how would you address it?
What do you think about
working for him? Sorry, continue. I'm saying working for him doesn't mean that it's the truth. Like, because something worked for him doesn't mean that is the truth. It may work for him, but it may not be the case that it may not be the case for the rest of the people.
Yeah, but but we face people today that aren't really, in most cases, concerned with the truth. Many are, but some people, these types of, you know, the hedonistic individual is not really concerned about the truth. He's more about utility, what works practically for me. You know, even if it's not true, it doesn't matter. So how would you arrest that type of person? Because a lot of people don't care for the truth these days, bro.
It's obvious.
Yeah.
You've got a genocide. People don't want to call it a genocide. Even these riots, the truth is... It's the emotions. You got to tackle the emotions.
This is a key point. How do we tackle such or give dawah to such a person?
Then we need to reframe the conversation a bit, awaken in their fitrah. So then we can ask them, so what do you think when these desires that you have take you to hell? Or let's say when you die and you face such consequences for all these desires, you pray, you worship your desires, you follow your desires. And what about if these desires take you to hell, to fire.
This may strike a nerve with some people, right? Naturally, this may, because that element of fear...
Sounds offensive as well.
Yeah, it can do, yeah. But so that may work for some people, but what about for the type that, you know, is really ardent, says, well, I don't care, we'll see
what
we get.
I'll be honest with you, like, I'm speaking like this because, and it sounds really rude to say, but I'm not thinking. It's like, it's just easy for me to think in this logical framework, and a lot of people I find when I'm speaking with them, when I'm trying to give dawah, it does require on our side a bit of intellectual capacity, energy, rigor. We have to do our research and understand what we're talking about.
Yeah.
The guy who's maybe non-religious, he's literally it's an NPC, he's man. It's like, I'm not thinking when I'm talking like this. I'm not thinking. Yeah. It's just like, it's the easiest thing which comes to my mind. Yeah. Maybe it's the devil, I don't know, but it's working for a lot of people.
Yeah, because at bottom, all it is, I'm relaxed, my life is good, I'm happy, I don't need God, religion, anything. That's what it is, essentially. That's what he's saying. Yeah. So how do you take such a person or a mindset or a psychology and get them to appreciate the value of Islam?
I'd ask them, what would happen to your state then when all of that's taken away?
Okay, good. So this is one.
If you suddenly become bedridden or sick, all those things that you hold dear, they're gone now. Your money's not going to help you. Your family can't help you. You're sick. You can die at any moment. And then even Allah talks about this in the Quran, where people go on a sinking ship. And then they suddenly start invoking Allah's name. The same thing will happen to you. Like, are you waiting for that moment?
Okay, so that's very powerful. That's one powerful, because you're taking them to a future situation through their imagination. You're getting to them to imagine these things. Okay, now everything's perfect and everything's good in your life. But what would you do if you were to end up with everything taken away from you, or your health's gone, or you lose all your money? You know, and because this is a possibility. It's a very real possibility. Yeah. Life changes in a moment sometimes, right? So you can get them into that framework and get them to think about these things. That's a very powerful way of doing it. So who would you turn to then?
I think, like you mentioned, question the purpose of the life, like everything that they do. So if you're having a life, a really easy life, everything works for you, I have a good job and I have this and that. If you question that, what's the purpose of you having a good job and what's the purpose? Until you get to the point of there's no actual purpose of me. So your purpose of living, working, is what? To come home, eat, sleep, and then what? So what's your purpose for when you
when you are 80 or 90 years old and you're about to die. So you're going to think back and think, well, like you mentioned, so what did you do with your life?
Yeah, right, so that's another good one.
Yeah.
See, go to the purpose.
Just the thing, like, in reflection, when I'm thinking like this, he will say, aha, exactly, it's a pragmatic belief. You know, if I'm ill, then it's good that I believe in this situation. If I was in a war zone, if I was suffering, if I had trauma, I would feel the need to look for a higher power. So it is a pragmatic belief. That, okay. So he would say something like this.
Okay, you can't, but then at that point, depending on what they, how they value truth,
yeah,
you can ask them. Well,
and then honestly, like, well, like, when I dig down into it, it does end up being a psychological, the Quran, when you mentioned about, like, the when if the angels came down and there was a stairs to heaven, like, you still wouldn't believe it's mm-hmm. it's true. And like, you have to kind of like identify whether there is any potential. Because if I'm thinking like this and having a conversation, then if I wanted to engage, if I wanted to investigate, then I would spar, I would kind of like engage. Whereas if I really didn't care, then I wouldn't care. I would give these kind of like aha, but
yeah.
answers.
Yeah.
So I think you need to identify who you're having a dialogue with, the kind of mindset it is. And I think 99% of the time it is psychological, it is a mental, emotional response as to why people don't care or engage with religion in the first place, or even believing in God, let alone the Islamic paradigm.
Yeah, it's either they are, life is good and that's all I care about right now, or it's either, you know, I have an emotional issue with religion, for maybe because I've gone through some sort of trauma in my life that I've misunderstood and blamed God for. But it's normally one of these two things, right? So these are a couple of things you can try. Reframe, taking them to a future situation and highlighting for them, what if this happens? What would you do then? What would you be your situation? Or the purpose of life. That's another good one.
Could you ask them if... Have they thought about what happens when you die?
Yeah, you can ask them as well. Anything to get them to... You know, because remember, this type of person is about the here and now. Right now I'm comfortable. Right now everything is good. I'm enjoying myself right now. So their frame right now is what prevents them from appreciating the things you're talking about. If you can take them out of that frame momentarily, even, and put them into a different frame, like the brother said, what if this was taken away from you, then that will encourage them to think differently and appreciate what you're talking about, right? But in most, some cases, you can try all of this, and even then they'll be like, I don't care. What do you do in that situation?
Move on.
Make dua for them.
Yeah.
And move. There's a point where you realize there's nothing else you can do. And it happens. You cannot, Allah guides who He wills, right? There will be people that you just can't get through to, no matter what you try. As long as you've tried your best, that's the key, right? Yes, bro.
And then if you're ever concerned, you need to remember that the Prophet, he had miracles, and there were still people who witnessed, what we believe, witnessed the miracles, for example, and they still didn't believe.
Yeah.
So if the Prophet was unable to convince certain people in the city, in the area, who are we to think that we're so pious and clever and intelligent? It comes with the ego as well. If you're like, you want him to convert, then it's like you're questioning, like, what's the rationale? So there's a lot of introspect, reflection that you have to undertake if that's an issue of why isn't he converting. So
yeah, that's a beautiful point. Yeah. It could be something that's internally with your ego, that you're getting frustrated, why isn't he converting? You know, what I'm saying should be working, you know, and then you start, it becomes this ego thing for you, where you then push further and go to a place where you start to get them agitated and angry, and then further distance themselves from Islam, right? So there's a point where you realize, have that emotional intelligence, that I need to stop now, I've done my bit, right? And like he said, there's examples of the time of the Prophet ﷺ. There were people that didn't accept, and then the Prophet ﷺ spoke to them, right? Now if that could happen with the Prophet of Allah, who are we, man? You know, there's going to be people that don't listen.
When he split the moon in front of everyone, and even then they still don't believe.
Yeah.
Change the tactics, and they will say that he's sahir, he's majnoon.
Yes, sometimes it takes an intervention by Allah for someone to fix their way. Like the story of the two gardeners in Surah Al-Kahf. Right? The two friends, one is rich, he has a lot of money, he has a lot of wealth, gardens with rivers flowing through them, date palms, fruits, everything, right? And then his friend who has some, but he doesn't have as much. And that dialogue between them is very... He gives his friend a reminder. You know, Allah gave you all this. This is from him. Turn back to him. But his friend is completely deluded because of his wealth.
You know, he doesn't even think the Day of Judgment is going to come. And even if it does, Allah's going to give him more because Allah's given him. He's completely deluded because of his material possessions.
We can give that example for somebody who says that I have everything, I'm comfortable, yeah. I don't.
That's a very powerful story, because what does it take for that person? Everything is destroyed. Allah takes everything away from him overnight. And that removes the veils from him. You know, and then he's rubbing his hands and he's like, only if I had an associated partners with Allah.
There's some stories, there's a couple of cases that I know of sportsmen who, I think one is an American football player, another one is a rugby player. They had one injury, big strong guys, where their discs, just completely shattered in their back. And I know of two cases that just couldn't take it. They were in chairs, and they eventually went to Switzerland and had assisted suicide. Wow. So just in one instant, their whole thing just goes.
Yeah, it's unfortunate, right? Okay, so going back now. Yes, Carlos.
Following on the conversation about the question of evil and heaven and hell and punishment and reward, I don't know if it ever comes up when doing dawah on the street, but it seems to me like, you know, if you have like a chair with a purpose and you're sitting on this chair and the chair suddenly collapses, are you going to blame the chair and take it out on the chair, or are you going to blame it on the designer and the manufacturer? So how do you answer? And I know what the answer is in a way, and it doesn't disprove the existence of God, but it does relate to the question of evil, in my opinion. So how do you answer this issue of accountability for your own design? You know, if the designer is perfection, why will the designer make something imperfect?
He's telling you already that he made the design in a way that it will break down, it will test you, and the way you respond to the test is what will then show who you actually are. Yeah, the designer is not saying I'm gonna make the most perfect chair that never breaks. He's telling you, he actually tells you that you're gonna go through issues with that chair, and the way you behave with that is who you actually are, basically.
I think it's something like that, but it's related to the issue of free will.
Yeah, what's the point of a perfect creation? There's literally no point of a perfect creation. If you're perfect, you can't display any good attributes. Because
plus when we say something is perfect, like when you define something as perfect, you're relating that concept of perfection to its purpose, right? So when you say like a chair is perfect, it's fit for purpose. You know, it will only be perfect if it does what it was designed to do, mm-hmm. right? So a chair is designed to be, in most cases, be sturdy and last you several years, so that you know you can make use of it. If you go get a cheap chair, then you know you get what you pay for. Mm. But if a chair lasts for say 10 years and it had a shelf life of say average 7, you would say it was a perfectly designed chair. It worked and it went beyond its shelf life. But Allah doesn't tell us that the human being is supposed to be is created in a way that he is perfect. Meaning that he lives forever and nothing goes wrong with him and he has the perfect life, because this isn't paradise. That life that we're talking about, that quote-unquote perfect life, where there's no illness, no sickness, no problems, no issues, no emotional issues, no bad thoughts, that's in paradise. That's in the life to come. But in this world, Allah has outlined the objective of us being here in this world. So in line with that objective, you can say that our creation is fit for purpose, in line with the objective of why we're here. Does that make sense?
Yes, it does, but I'm not sure that fully addresses the issue of accountability. I mean, I think the brother said, you know, that why would you create something perfect in terms of a human being? And I get that. But if God, as Islam believes, that knows past, present, and future, then there is this issue of free will, where you have to balance, you have to
choose.
What's the word? Not choose, but you have to reconcile the fact that the Creator creates something with full knowledge of the outcome,
yeah,
and allows this outcome, however imperfect, however.
So basically, free will versus determinism is what he's talking about.
Yeah. Does it make sense what I'm saying?
Yeah, I would like to address this on the same example that Carlos pointed out. So if a creator of this chair, he designed this chair in a good way, and he has a catalog for this, and he says that this is for one person, and this is with these options. If you overload it with two people, or if you use it in a different way, that will be broken.
Yes.
So the human being is the same. It's created, and Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala knows the best about him, or this creation, and he guided this creation that do this and do not do this.
Yeah.
If you do this, you will go to paradise, and if you don't, you will go to hell.
Mm.
So we have the free will now. If you are overloading this chair, it will be broken down.
Yes. Yes.
Otherwise, if you use it properly, the way the creator or designer told us that this will long for 10 years, that will.
Yes. Is that, yeah, okay, perfect. Yeah, mashallah. Anything else you want to add to that, brothers? So it's about you basically using your free will to choose what's right and in line with the divine will, which Allah has revealed to us in the Quran, and therefore you'll be successful, right? So, but if you don't, then you face the consequences in this life and in the hereafter, right? So that mechanism is built in, where if you don't do what you were created to do, you will break down, right? And that is perfection from the perspective of our design in relation to the purpose we were created, right? So that the purpose comes into it as well. It's in line with the purpose we were created for, right? We weren't created in this life to have fun, enjoy ourselves, and live forever, right? And do whatever you want. That's not the purpose of being here. The purpose of being in this life is what? To worship Allah. You know, and this life is what? It's a test. You know, to see which of us are best in action, in deeds, in the choices that we make and the things that we do. So if we do the right things and we try our best and we worship Allah, we will be successful in this life and the hereafter. But if we don't, then we would bear the consequences of that. And that's where the free will comes into it. So we are responsible, essentially, as well. But then obviously this tangents off into the discussion between free will and determinism, which we can get into a bit later if you guys want, which is always an interesting topic. But for now, are we all good with what we're discussing so far, yeah? Inshallah. Yeah. So where were we? We were talking about
existence of God.
And someone that says that they don't believe, they're not interested at all, right? So there's a point where you say enough is enough, that you've done your dawah, then you just move on to the next person, okay? Say if someone now is interested, right? They don't believe in God. They don't have really good reasons not to believe in God, right? But then they're interested, they want to know. What would you say? What arguments would you share with them? Or what would you present to them as far as arguments? And that is assuming they need an argument. Remember the whole thing we discussed about get to know the person? Like if someone is interested in wanting to know about God, it doesn't logically follow that they definitely need a logical argument for God's existence. Right? They may just need some ayat of the Quran or something about who Allah is. Right? They may not even need a logical proof for God's existence. But assuming this person needs a logical proof for God's existence, what logical proofs can you give? What arguments can you share with them? Okay, you could use a design argument. Does anyone have a preferable sort of design argument that they use?
If, for example, the phone just didn't create itself, there was a creator, someone who created it, and the human are much more complicated than this phone. So clearly, if this phone requires a creator, then what such complicated beings that we are, surely that requires a creator as well.
Okay, so a simple design argument, right? You can show something that's designed or created by people and highlight, well, if this needs a designer, then the universe must surely need a designer, because the universe is far more complex and ordered than these things that we have within the universe. If anything, the things you have within the universe require the order of the universe, right? So the physical laws of the universe weren't there, the mathematical laws weren't there, you wouldn't have the things we have in this world, right? So you can make this argument. Any others?
I think we can argue as well that as a human being, if I'm a powerful man who can have all the ability, let's say, to bypass all the law, everything, so who will put me accountable for my bad deeds? For example, if, God forbid, I kill thousands of people, who will put me accountable if I'm powerful than the law and everything, police and everything? So what will happen to me if I can survive this life and then nothing will be happen to me? So this is injustice system that designed in.
So you think ultimate justice has to be established?
Yeah, there should be some justice. Somebody should be accountable if we are over the law, above the law. So there should be a system put me accountable for.
Yeah. That point, I think it was Sheikh Salman Sugimoto from Japan, the brother used to work for IRA, mashallah. If I'm not mistaken, this was the reason he came to Islam. It wasn't, and he's done a translation of the Quran now, mashallah, in Japanese. And his reason, if I can remember correctly, was that this whole injustice in this world, he couldn't make sense of it. Mm. But Islam made sense of it for him. And that was sufficient to awaken his fitrah.
What, David Ridgman, essentially?
Yeah, that everything will be equalized. Yeah. Everything will be, you know, everyone will be justly treated and justice will be done on the Day of Judgment. Mm. You know, even animals won't be wrong.
Yeah.
SubhanAllah. Yeah, so that's a very powerful point. Yeah? And we can appreciate why it would have such an impact on a person who's quite been questioning this injustice in the world for probably decades. And then finally gets the answer. You know, it is all equalized. And yes, it makes sense. There must be a creator who does ultimate justice. Right? It's not really a logical argument per se, right? But it's something that triggers the fitrah, it's intuitive.
Similar point, like relating to purpose, is that wherever you look, you see things dying and being brought to life. So what is the purpose of that? Like even a fruit that grows, eventually it becomes expired and becomes, you know, dead. Same of plants, same of humans, we live and we die. What would be the point of that? Why don't we live forever? I'd get them to question, what is the end goal here? Why is it that everything around us is made to come alive and then die again?
Yeah. Purpose is a very powerful one, right? Because everyone's looking for purpose. Everyone asks the question of purpose at some point. Yes, bro?
I think just an extension on this argument is maybe talking about morality as well, objective truth, what is good, what is bad. Is rape good or bad? If it's bad, is it bad throughout all of time? If so, why? Where did it come from? Is it based on societal norms, or is it from maybe a divine source, something external to human society, or maybe it's inside of us, the fitra? Where does that come from? And then I guess this argument could be related to, you know, the infinite regress argument. Hijab talks about how it must come from somewhere. Then it's like contingent versus independent, non-independent. I need to brush up a little bit on that argument, but I think that argument is quite solid on how to break away from that infinite regress. It must come from something, and then that the question is, what is that something? And then that's another conversation. Yeah. But that could help segment and provide logical answers to the oneness of God, or what kind of God is there?
Yeah.
And then but as long as the understanding is that I believe in something, then you can kind of push him and show that there's a logical conclusion as to the oneness of that and the attributes of that oneness, i.e. the Islamic understanding of Allah, of God. Yeah.
You go on, brother. Was it? Someone. Yes, sir.
You can also have a question to trigger the fitra as well. Sometimes we see an accident, so four people in the car, they die, and one person survives. So how it can, if it's a automatic system or designed like by itself, this human, this all the universe, including the earth, so how four people can die and one survive?
Mm.
How can this happen?
Yeah.
Or even somebody can be saved in a few seconds, and somebody can die. So how can this work?
Yeah, yeah. That's another. So you can make specific examples of things that happen in the
yeah.
world. Yeah. But the purpose and purpose, meaning, morality, these are very big things in our society today. Right? So if you look at the crises of the modern West, you know, with all of its, mashallah, you know, technology and all of these amazing things that we have, the crisis, the Achilles heel, if you like, of the modern secular world is meaning and morality. Right? Ultimate meaning and objective morality is lost in the absence of God. Right? And both of these things are fundamental to the human being. You require both of these things. Civilizations are built upon these things, meaning and morality. Right? Now, if you think about the question of meaning, what is the ultimate meaning of life in the absence of God? What is the answer?
There's no purpose.
There is no purpose.
You create your own purpose.
You create your own purpose, yeah. That's what the existentialist philosophers were doing. Yeah. That's why they became very popular.
Nietzsche.
Yeah. Yeah? After the people turned away from God and became modern, you know, and secular, this crisis emerged. Now there's no meaning left. Whereas, although, you know, in Christianity, when Christianity was dominant, at least people had the higher purpose, which was, you know, God. Now, in the absence of God, there is no ultimate purpose. People are lost, and this existentialist philosophers became very popular. Nietzsche, Jean-Paul Sartre, Kierkegaard, and all of these other guys, right? Because they spoke about meaning and purpose, existential stuff, right? And their idea was, you create your own meaning and your own purpose, right? But what's the problem with that?
So let's just say they say you create your own purpose. Okay, and I come to the conclusion that my purpose in life is to help others. And that's a beautiful purpose because, you know, I feel good after that. But then I can also say, actually, I don't want to help other people. I want to kill people. And they will say, oh, but that's wrong. Okay. The question would be, why is that wrong?
Yeah.
Because now, who sits? What's right? What's wrong? What's moral? What's not moral? What's objective? What's subjective? So, if you don't have someone that sits, a higher power, that sets those standards, then basically you can't decide what's, like, humans cannot decide what's objective or what's.
And that's a powerful point because it ties meaning and morality together. Both those issues. Because the problem of meaning is also a problem of morality. Because now if someone's creating their own meaning, say person X says, you know, I want to do charity, that's the meaning of my life, and person Y says, the meaning of my life is to kill one person a week, hypothetically speaking, yeah? They both ascribe meaning to their life, and the meaning they're giving themselves is a moral question. You know, is it good or bad, the purpose you're giving? So you have two problems now. One, you're making stuff up for yourself. You're literally making it up. That's what you're doing. You're ascribing meaning to yourself. Yeah? So it's subjective meaning. And on top of it, is it a good meaning or not? Right? And then who determines what is right or wrong? Without an objective anchor, it's human subjectivity. Right? So say, you know, Tariq wants to go and beat up, I don't know, pensioners every Sunday. Yeah? And you and what's your name, brother? Sorry?
Usman.
Usman doesn't agree with him. Right? And he says to Tariq, that's bad, bro. Don't do that. Why would you do that? All Tariq has to say is, why is it bad? I think it's good. What's Usman going to say?
I'll give a pragmatic answer, but you go to prison.
So you could use utilitarian approach, right? That it's going to lead to a bad consequence.
Yeah.
But Tariq can say, well, that's possible. But also another possibility is, I just go undercover each time I do that.
It's worth it.
Yeah, or you could just say, yeah, it's worth it. I want to go to prison. It's a good thing for me.
He's sure that nobody can touch him.
Yeah, or you can be sure, yeah. So, yeah. Yeah. So do you see the problem? If there's no objective anchor to ground moral values and duties in, you run into a problem. It's just human subjectivity.
Why would Tariq go to prison?
For killing of...
It's not good for society.
Yeah, they can make that argument. Yeah, but Tariq could say, once I beat them up, I treat them and I take them to hospital and then I buy them an ice cream afterwards.
You can argue that pensioners are taking pension from the government, so by getting rid of them, it makes the economy more.
Would you like it done to you? Would you like it done to you?
Yeah.
That's what they would say. It's What's the liberal argument they say? Yeah. Do anything as long as it's in harm, the harm principle, want, right? Yeah. So
there's a movie called Logan's Run, a 70s movie, where once somebody gets to 35, they're all the government. It's like the rule; they have to kill them.
My God,
they won't be here.
But you see, the problem it's all subjective.
Yeah,
yeah. And then everyone could come up, and we see this happening in the world today. There are things being justified today which would be seen as abhorrent even 10 years ago, right, or 15 years ago. It's all free flow now. You know, it just as long as there's a group of people that agree on a concept or idea, and then it's enforced. If they have the power, they enforce it. You know, and then it has to be accepted then it's as a moral, you know, right. Mm. But it's not objective any, it's just a subjective opinion, and things keep changing, right? And views keep changing. But we have objective, we believe in objective morality because it's grounded in Allah. It comes from the Creator, you know, so it's grounded. That is our anchor.
So you basically just have to argue the fundamental first principle, and then that's where the argument stems from. So it's, but I don't agree with your God, then it's okay, but then... they say, I don't believe in the Quran or God or whatever, or these arguments. And then you'd say, first principally speaking, like, you tackle liberal... I think Brother Hijab did this, you know, you tackle the liberal paradigm and say it's contradictory for X, Y, and Z. You know, it's a circular argument, is what he mentioned about liberalism. And then you could argue for the Islamic paradigm or the religious paradigm and God, that it makes more logical sense because of...
So
you'd have to go on the fundamental first principles. Course, and that's with any dialogue in philosophy and conversation. But 9 times out of 10, it doesn't really come to that because people aren't intellectually aware or they're not scholars. This is more of like an academic understanding, or it's more the emotional side of it. And you mentioned the brother from Japan. He converted simply just because of the justice on the Day of Judgment. So it's just that... you got to find who you're speaking with.
And know what's concerning them.
Yeah.
You know, what is concerning them in their life. Some people, it is meaning. Like, what is the meaning of my life? They don't know. They're looking for it.
Yeah.
Right? And then Islam gives meaning. It tells us what meaning is. Allah created us to worship. You know, and living in this world and doing acting in this world is a part of worship. So you can go down that route. Right? Any other proofs or arguments you can use?
Could you also, like, say to them, look, everything you do in life has a purpose. When you wake up, you brush your teeth, it's got a purpose. You eat food, you got a purpose. You go to work, you got a purpose.
What's your purpose?
What's your purpose exactly?
Yeah, so you can go down that line as well. Get them to appreciate the need for, you know, everything has a purpose. You know, everything has a purpose. Even the things we make have a purpose, but what about yourself? You know, so there's that need there. Any other arguments you can use?
Could you perhaps use the argument of how many people who achieve wealth and status and fame, so how much of them are upset, you know, they're unhappy, they commit suicide, like, you know, these.
You can use that to highlight that is not the ultimate goal of life, because if it was, then these people would be happy, period. But it doesn't satisfy them in some cases, at least, you know, and it leads to, you know, suicide or depression or whatever the case is. Yeah, you can mention that as well. Any other arguments?
For God, you mean?
Yeah, God's existence. Carlos, how long have we been going for?
1 hour and 14 minutes.
14, okay, so we'll wrap up for today, I guess, inshallah. But is there any questions regarding God's existence improving, or anything based on what we've discussed today?
So I was going to ask about the contingency argument, and maybe you can touch up on that maybe in another day.
There's many forms of it. Hijab is the best person on the contingency.
It's in Nandani as well.
Sorry?
It is in Nandani.
Nandani, so definitely check that out.
He's written a book as well.
Yeah, but the gist of it...
This one, yeah.
Yeah, but the gist of it is that things are in two states. Either they're contingent or they're independent. Yeah. Necessary, right? Necessary or contingent. And what he argues is that everything ultimately has to rest upon something necessary and independent. Right, and then the whole argument is based on that, going back to the first course.
It stems from the top Islamic scholars, and like even looks at it from the secular perspective.
Yeah.
So like it's a great summary. I think it's one of the best arguments.
Yeah, it's very powerful.
It's very powerful.
Especially if you can simplify it.
Yes.
You know, if you could simplify and present it to people, then it's a formidable argument, honestly.
Yeah.
But the key is in simplifying it, because if you use the academic version,
Yeah. In most cases, it goes over people's heads.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So the trick is in finding a way of simplifying it enough where people can understand what you're saying.
And Hijabi even concluded in the book that it's just like people, like even if they understood it, it's psychological as to why they don't believe in God or not. Like that's the fundamental conclusion as to why people choose or maybe choose not to convert or not to believe in God. It's a psychological, the emotional side of it. So no matter how much logical stuff you can throw at them, 9 times out of 10 it might infuriate them even more.
Yeah, and this is what you need to know. You see a red flag, meaning you recognize it's not a rational problem, you stop with the rational arguments, put them away, say, look, let's go for a cup of tea, a coffee, you know, what was it that happened in your life that took you away from God? Or did you, another good question is, did you ever believe in God? Right, so take them back to that point. And what happened that took you away from that belief? Because if you can get to the crux of the problem, the easier it's going to be to give these people some good dawah, inshallah. You know, but if you keep, like if it's an emotional problem and you keep tackling it on a rational level, it's not going to work. You're not going to get anywhere. So again, the key point is, yes, rational arguments have a place in the dawah, but you have to figure out from your discussion with that person is as to whether they need a rational argument or not. Or whether they need something else, you know. They just need someone to speak to. Maybe some ayat of the Quran. Maybe they need to be taken to another place in their mind where when everything is taken away from them. Or maybe they need to be taken to the moment they turned away from God because of a calamity or a trial that happened in their life. Right? So you have to have that emotional intelligence, that awareness to be able to navigate that space with that person, inshallah. Right. Any other questions? Cool. So next week we'll go into oneness, inshallah. And hopefully do 2 sections, oneness and revelation, inshallah. Yeah. May Allah bless you guys. JazakAllah khair. Assalamu alaikum.